Today, I wanted to speak about a subject which I think is something which everybody, at one point or another, thinks about, worries about, and tries to understand. I know that there are many people who don't worry too much about life, who think that things are okay the way they are, who are not terribly concerned with esoteric questions. But at one point in everybody's life, there comes a time when situations demand that we question. We question life. We question ourselves. We question what we are doing and how we are doing it. I know that some people don't speak about this. Some people suffer in quiet, suffer in silence. Some people just take this questioning and leave it very deeply buried. Some people go to psychotherapy and discuss it. Some people go to mystics. Some people go to friends and talk about it. Some people research and read about it. Some people join religions and get somebody else's answer about it. Some people do things to try to discover it on their own. Some people get some realization. But everybody deals with it in their own particular way. One of the natures of life, one of the natures of the way things work for all of us, is that we are essentially beings who question. We have a rationality, and beings, living beings, who question. We have rationality. We have the idea to understand things from a point of view which ordinarily we might not understand. We have a way to go about asking about things and questioning things which are certainly important to us, which are certainly important to everybody. And considering all of this, we have capacities which are far beyond what we think we have. Now, I know sometimes these questions are existential questions, and we have discussed these in the past. Questions which deal with life. And a lot of the time we look in the stars or we look in the sky and we say, what is the point of life? Why am I here? What is the point? What is the purpose of my existence? And naturally, this is an important question. In fact, it is one of the most important questions. We even find these kind of questions discussed by all religions all over the world. In fact, it is this very question which formulates the basis for all religion. Why am I here? What is really the point of my life? What is the purpose of my life? Now, I understand finding the answers to this is very difficult. And in fact, I'm asked this question by people every day, multiple times a day. And I myself find myself in a situation where I'm asking this question about what I think. I ask myself the same question. What is this all about anyway? I especially ask this question when everything's going wrong, or when things are very stressed, or when relationships are difficult, or people die, or even I contemplate them dying, or I contemplate pets not being here anymore, or I contemplate wars in other parts of the world, or disasters that are taking place. There are many things which make me deeply question about life. So this morning when I was sitting in front of the deities, now this was a very interesting experience. Here I am trying to meditate in front of the deities. And I'm trying to understand things. The deity said, just calm down. And then I was thinking about service and being of service. Now, I know that it has been said that our whole purpose is to serve. But actually, that's not really so. That's not necessarily related to a purpose. It is related to an activity we can do. Or even more specifically, it is related to a function of that relates to the nature of our souls, the nature of our spirits. Just like it is the nature of water to flow. It's just something water does. You can't stop that. You don't have to teach water how to flow. You can't transform water. Of course, you can freeze it or you can turn it into a gas. But when it's in its liquid state, the nature of water is to flow. Now, even if you put it in a glass, if you make a hole in the glass, it flows. So sometimes it may not flow when it's contained. We as living beings have as our nature this service activity, the service desire. We wish to be of service. And whenever there's a possibility for that to manifest, when we're not in a glass container, when we're not enclosed in some way, our desires to be of service flow. And flow in different ways. Flow towards people or living beings or our gardens or our country or society or humanity or whatever. Yet, you would not think of the purpose of water as being the flowing. You would think of the purpose, if you had to give a purpose to water, you would think of the purpose of water as the foundation of life, that which supports all of the cells in our body, that which gives life the possibility to exist wherever it may exist. For without water, there can be no life. So you would not think of the flowing as the purpose. You would think of it as the nature, the sustenance or the nourishing is the purpose. I mean, of course, that's from our point of view. It's relative. So let's go back to ourselves. Service is our nature. It doesn't necessarily relate to our purpose. Now, you could talk generically about our purpose in the absolute so-called realm. In other words, if you were to take us as living beings, separate ourselves from this world, separate ourselves from all of the bodily entanglements or even subtle entanglements, just leave us as entities who are in the natural spiritual position, you could say, you could speak about our purpose as being that which is absorbed within the Supreme or absorbed within the energy of spirit or absorbed within somehow coming in contact with God, Radha and Krishna, if you will. But when you take that spirit and place that spirit where we are now, and after all, that's what really counts to us now because we're here, you wouldn't speak of it in the same way because we are in another situation. Now, I know there are religionists who say this is all simply a temporary, illusory thing, and really all that counts is our purpose in connection with the divine. That's okay in the sense that that's one way to look at it. But there are other significant things. And it is my strong feeling that these other significant ways of looking at it are more relevant to us, especially when we start asking questions when we are in distress. Let's say I'm in a distressful situation. I've lost someone I love, or I'm in an economic crisis, or I have a health crisis, or whatever. At that time, when I'm in this distressful situation, I ask questions, but I don't ask questions which are so much related to that absolute purpose. I ask questions because I have been stimulated by the specific need or the specific situation around me. Now, I know you could say that's a subtle point. After all, if I'm entangled in this world and it's giving me pain, and I come to understand that that absolute realm will give me relief from the pain, as far as I'm concerned, that's all I need to know about my purpose. But that only works so long as you can maintain that idea, so long as I can have relief from that idea. But after a while, everybody has the experience, to be quite frank, that that one idea doesn't remain relevant in our lives at all times. There are questions which arise which relate to what's going on around us, which relate to our bodies and so on. Somebody may speak of it in terms of faith, that you don't have enough faith, or somebody may have, you don't have enough trust, or somebody may say you've got to always constantly remind yourself. But I want to talk about it in another way today. I want to look at this from a wholly different point of view. And this point of view came to me in a very interesting way when I was sitting in front of the deities. I'm sitting in front of the deities this morning trying to meditate on what to talk about. And my cat, well, of course, I can't call him my cat, the cat who lives with us, our companion Julius, he walks in the temple room and sits down next to me and looks at me like, what are you doing in here? Why aren't you playing with me? So I thought I would pacify him. So I was petting him on the head, but I wasn't really paying attention to him. I was trying to meditate with the deities and just patting him on the head. Well, you know, cats are not stupid, and they have this like incredible psychic capacity. They work on all kinds of dimensions. They're really powerful little things, those little kits. So he knew I was just playing with him and that I wasn't paying attention. So he reached up, took his claw, and went on my hand. And then I look at him like, what did you do that for? And he's just looking at me like, are you kidding? You call that petting? You think you're fooling me? So then I get up, and of course I put something on it. And then I come back, and then I'm thinking about this. And I'm thinking, you know, here it is. Here I think I'm doing something to help him, and he's getting mad at me. And then I was thinking, hey, this is just the way it is with therapy. Sometimes you go into therapy with somebody, and then you end up getting angry at them. They become the object of your anger. In therapy, it's a phenomenon. A phenomena in therapy, when you go into therapy with others, that you project your anger onto the therapist. You project your frustration onto the therapist, and the therapist becomes the sum total of your anger in therapy. So you just become angry at them, at your anger and frustration. And so then I'm looking at the deities and I'm thinking, gee, you know, what a great theme. So then I came up with the idea. I was going to label this discussion, what if life was one big therapy session? But that was such a long title, it would have just filled up the whole screen and it would have been flowing back and forth in Winamp all day. So I decided not to do that. But that's actually a really cool subject. What if life is just one big therapy session? And then I was thinking, sometimes people, they hate God, or they blame God for everything. Now that would make sense if you see God in terms of being the therapist. And this existence that we're in is the therapist's office. And you look at God as the one who forces you to see yourself. Just picture this. When you take a particular form, between lives, when you figure out or you are helped to figure out, when you understand the best possible form you could be in, to take birth in, so that you can enter into the next lifetime in such a way that it will maximize, it will amplify your capacity to understand yourself. So just think about this. In between lives, you are assisted to accept some kind of therapeutic circumstance. Just think about some of these movie stars who have so many troubles and they have to go to some therapeutic retreat so that they can take up a new role and get themselves healthy again. So let's say we take up this form, this body. It's our therapeutic role we have to play within a specific set of circumstances. And in this specific set of circumstances, we are forced in various ways to look at ourselves, to see ourselves, to be very aware of ourselves, and to get an opportunity to deal with that. Let's go back for a second and discuss about what is a therapist. A therapist is somebody who has an office. You go to the office. You sit there. You speak to this person. The person simply asks questions like, how are you doing today? And how do you feel about that? And does that remind you of anything? And, I see. I understand. So what's happening is that the therapist is helping you to speak about things. And when something interesting comes up, the therapist says, now that's a very interesting point. Can we examine that? Why don't you talk about how your father dealt with you? Or how your mother responded like this? Or how did you feel when you were in school? Or whatever. So the therapist simply causes us to look at ourselves. Causes us to look at the way we feel, to examine it, look at the way we think, clarify it. And then oftentimes, the therapist performs a wonderful service of having us admit to ourselves how we feel, how we think. Because on some occasions, we are the last people to understand how we feel. Maybe everybody else around us understands. Maybe all kinds of people know many things, but we are hiding from ourselves. And therefore, we don't want to accept how we feel. So the therapist basically puts a mirror up before us so that we see ourselves clearly. And when we try to look away, the therapist says, no, look. Just like we may have a little mark on our face. And when we look in the mirror, we look everywhere, but we don't look at that. So then the therapist says, no, look at that. How does that make you feel when you look at that? Why? Tell me about it. So let's go back to the example of therapy and life. Let's say God is the therapist. This surrounding world around us is the office. And the particular body we are in right now is the patient, sitting in that office. Now, let's say we can't see the therapist. But there are many ways that we know the therapist is there. For example, consequences. When we do something, there are consequences. There are resultant actions which are put into motion, which come back to us. There is our memory, where we remember what has taken place. And we have emotional responses to these memories. There is also the unconscious, the hidden part of us, which comes out at night when we dream. There's also the shadow, where we are having others relate with us, and we are seeing as their shadows our own consciousness or our own subconsciousness. Let's say you have a person, and that person is facing you. Let's say that person is reacting towards us, and we react towards them in a way which is not necessarily appropriate to the way they are reacting towards us. Often what that means is we see in that person a shadow of ourselves, and we are reacting seemingly to them, but in reality we are reacting to ourselves we see in them. We are reacting to what we see in them that we know is within us. But maybe it's within us on a deep level, a very unconscious level, or in our subconsciousness. So what a marvelous therapeutic experience. When we are unable to see ourselves and admit, the therapist, in this sense God, sends to us people who have qualities and who act in ways which illuminate the dark part of our being and cause us to see a reflection of the very thing in ourselves we are trying to avoid. So we look at that, and it makes us upset. It makes us angry. And it makes us frustrated. And we respond to that. And we blame these people for being this way or that way or the other way. Because in reality, it's exactly what we are or want to do. But because we have not been able to be honest with ourselves, we have not been able to admit to ourselves that this is really the point in our own lives, we blame them. We attack them. We say they are the whole problem. So the therapist, God, arranges circumstances, arranges people, or even arranges reactions in our own body, where our own bodies start relating to all of this, to start resonating to all of this, and start responding harmonically to all of this stimulus that is taking place. And ultimately, we are creating our universe this way. So we are in the therapist's office, and we are creating the atmosphere in the office. And the therapist is simply showing us, is simply reflecting what it is that we are, what it is that we are creating. Now, interestingly enough, there are various responses we can make. Some people become depressed. They say, "Why am I like that? I am bad. It's all useless. There is no hope." Some people become suicidal. Some people become frustrated and angry and blame all of those who have caused them to be in this horrible situation. Some people blame God, the therapist. Just like here I am, trying to help my cat, Julius, by petting him on the head. He turns to me and attacks me because I wasn't honest in my care for him. So he became angry at the therapist. Wow, what a point. Why we become angry at God? We become angry and we place our anger on that person who displayed it to us, displayed our fault, reflected our problematic quality. We blame God. Now, okay, let's understand that with Julius again. He's walking in the door, so I don't want to talk about him too much. But he was upset because I didn't understand what he wanted. He communicated to me. I knew exactly what he was communicating. And still, I wanted to do something else. In the mentality of a cat, that is an extreme offense. But sometimes, Julius or Suchi or whoever, they communicate. But I don't understand. What do you want? Now, I don't understand what they want. So what happens then is that they're frustrated because I don't understand them. Now let's examine that. A communication is more than just an expression. Now we're going to get into very fine lines of distinction. And I think it's very valuable to make these fine lines. For example, if I speak to you and you do not understand what I'm saying, I would not consider that a communication. I would consider that I'm speaking, you may be hearing, but there's no connection. To communicate really means that what you say, others understand. That's why when we speak about language, we speak about the art of communicating. It is the art of sharing, which means that what I say you understand, and you reply accordingly. I understand, I reply. This is a communication, a dialogue. But if I say to you, and you go, huh? Now, I'm speaking, but I'm not communicating because it made no sense to you. And when, for example, I'm trying to tell you something and I'm just getting more and more angry because you don't understand, I might do something violent, or I may just close myself up in frustration. I may smash something. Or I may blame myself for being stupid. Sometimes people become criminal. If you analyze the criminal mentality, a person may turn to be a criminal simply because they have not been able to communicate properly in their lives. They have not been able to communicate how they feel. They have not been able to communicate how they think. They have never been able to communicate to others and get a proper, appropriate response. And because of this, they feel that the world is against them. The world does not understand them. Society does not understand them. And therefore, it is their right to steal or to harm because society or people deserve it because they have not been accepted. This person who's frustrated has not been accepted by society, has not accepted the communication, has not accepted them. or in some cases even tried. So it's very important that everybody be allowed to engage in this process of communication, of sharing. Again, we have this idea of therapy. The main thing about therapy is that you assume this therapist is a trained person and understands everything you say, and that you, when you speak, they understand and they respond appropriately. That's a given. Otherwise, why would you go? Why would you pay money? And so when you're in this therapeutic environment, of course, we're talking from the point of view of life as being one big therapy session. And again, this is related to the purpose of life. The purpose of life as life being one big therapy session. So when you enter into this therapeutic environment, but the therapist, you think, doesn't understand you, you get very frustrated. You even may smash the lamp in the office of the therapist or break the flower vase, throw glass, throw something heavy through the window. So therefore, I would propose it's important to understand that these people around you are not your therapists. It is not their responsibility to understand you. It is not their responsibility to assist you. Now, a lot of people don't understand that. They demand that others understand them. And they demand that to such a degree that they even forget or neglect that their first responsibility is to understand others. In other words, it's not a responsibility that we have that others understand us first. It's not that we can look at another person and demand that they understand us first. We have no control over other people. We have control over ourselves. And we can say that we'll first make the effort to understand others. In other words, we become the therapist, not that we force others to be the therapist. And now we come to the point of our nature again. Because you can see how this integrates perfectly. Our nature is to be of service. And here's exactly how it manifests in every moment. When you demand that others understand you, you have turned it around. Instead of you acting according to your nature, which is to be of service, you have now demanded that the other be of service to you. And here's where the definition of service is very interesting. Because when you demand others to serve you as your therapist or as your provider or whatever, that person's nature is being twisted from that of being of service to others to being your servant. In other words, instead of the nature manifesting in this voluntary, loving way, it becomes a demand. So it becomes a slavery rather than service. Let's go back and summarize this picture again. Considering life as one big therapy session, and considering that God is the therapist, and considering that we are all manifestations of God, and considering there's only one of us, and considering that it is our nature to be of service, we therefore have a nature of being therapists. In that sense, to assist others, to not react when others see themselves in us. Did you understand that, Siddha? To not react when others see themselves in us. I'll give you an example. Let's say somebody's angry. They're angry at us because they are seeing in us themselves. And they're reacting against that. So one of our functions as the therapist is to not react personally to that. In other words, to become neutral while they are reacting to themselves. To not attack them and amplify the situation. Now, attacking the therapist is a normal response that takes place in every therapy environment. People end up attacking the therapist because the therapist shows them things about themselves they do not want to see, they do not like. And therefore they get upset. And when they're upset, they point at the therapist and say, "You made me feel bad. It is your fault." People say this to God all the time. Why am I in this situation? How could this happen to me? Why is God doing this to me? And then they end up being frustrated, angry, upset. They rebel in different ways. Just like a criminal in childhood who wasn't understood or who was never cared for, blames his mother or father or his society or community, and therefore in frustration rebels against it and causes problems to others because of that. Who steals or causes crimes or does things harming or becomes a twisted personality. And that same exact thing is happening the way we deal with God. Who's that therapist? Because others represent God. We end up with that feeling towards others. We project those feelings on others. We project our frustrations on others. We project our anger on others. And they reflect it back to us when they are not in a patient mood. When they are not in the mood of being of service. Or when they don't understand what you are doing. Remember, when we are demanding of others, we are not working with them according to their natures. We are transforming their natures, trying to turn them into slaves, people who must do what we want, instead of working with their natures and allowing them to be of service as we allow ourselves to be of service to them in a loving exchange. And when we think about the purpose of life, which was, after all, the question which we started everything off with in this discussion today, and we see life as a therapy session, we can start to understand that purpose a little better. I'm not going to say that this is the purpose of life, and I've clarified it for everybody, and this is it, write it down and translate it into 100 languages. I am saying that this is a very good way to understand the purpose, but that we all have to understand it in our own way. Because when we see our purpose as being within this therapy session, that doesn't finalize the answer to the question. It doesn't resolve the question. It just clarifies the purpose of the life. In other words, the life is meant to understand something. The life is meant to realize something. It's the purpose of it. It's what the point of it is. It is not the ultimate something. It's the means. Of course, whenever you say means, people ask, what's the end? And that's where eternal comes in. There is no end. Life is a means. Period. Life is a means. Period. That's the purpose of life. There is no end. It is a means by which we expand, we evolve. Our existence becomes clearer and clearer, and we know more and more. Some people think that the more you know, the more you smile. That may be true. The more you know, the more you realize, why am I upset? It just is. But that requires detachment. But then sometimes we become so detached, we lose contact with ourselves, and we walk out of the therapist's office. And then we're no longer in the purpose of life. We think we've found the solution, the end. And that lasts for some time. But we have to come back in the office again, because at one point, when we're out there in detached, smiling land, something gnaws at us and says, damn, I thought that this was all over. But it's not. And then you got to go back in the therapist's office again. But anyway, it's fun to go out and have a smiling, detached vacation. But ultimately, you got to get back in that office again. And the funny thing is that if I were to say the smile detached is useless, I would be an idiot. If I were to say the vacation off in religion land is useless, I would be foolish. If I were to say a vacation off to religion land, you know, you like have Disneyland. You've heard of that? So religion land. Yeah. And so let's say you would go off to liberation land. All of these things are great. All of these things are important. All of these things are part of the means, but the purpose remains the same: to stay within the therapeutic environment and to continuously evolve, continuously go through this therapeutic existence until you reflect perfectly the role of God as the supreme therapist. Then your divine nature will fully manifest in relation to others. Okay, for those of you who thought that was a very relieving final statement, I'm sorry, but it's not. Because let's go back and discuss the therapist. Therapists are interesting because while they are acting as this fatherly or motherly assistant to you, or whatever role you want to place them in, they are helping you. But they are being affected. They are somehow or another learning from their patients. They're learning because their patients bring up things which make them think about themselves, or which make them think about life, or which make them understand more, or which affect them. You know, we've heard about this ever-expanding jazz, that God is ever-expanding, we're always expanding, everything's expanding. Well, let's think of it this way, in the therapy example, that we're constantly building upon each other. We're building upon each other as we grow together. And all of us are building together. And God is engaged in the exact same interaction, but with everybody, and is similarly growing. So the therapist is also in therapy by being the therapist, because everybody's expanding from the experience. So even if you are the perfect manifestation of the divine therapist, you are affected by those who you interact with in the therapeutic environment, and you are also expanding in that way. Therefore, there's no finality. No position where you're freed from having to be in therapy. Where you walk out the door and shut the door and say, I am free. I am liberated from all of this educational experience. I have nothing more to learn about myself. Well, if you had nothing more to learn about yourself, then that would mean you are a finite thing. You fit within a certain border, and your qualities and characteristics and that which you know and all that fits in a very defined box. And at one point, you have gone through and explored all parts of that box. But it's not so. Because every single thing you do creates a form of expansion in one way or another. Either directly or indirectly. Multidimensionally. Through time. Spiritually. And also here experientially. Because that is the nature of life. There's always an expansion. It's not like death, where things are diminishing. It's expanding. So there's never a point at which you can go through this entire defined box. But there is a point where you're so far in your exploration of this box that you can keep consciously pushing the limits of it. Expanding it. You consciously do it. At this point, it's called conscious evolution. Instead of having to play catch-up means having to go and figure it out when it's wrong, or figure it out after it's already manifested, or figure it out when it's already gone totally wrong and you're all screwed up. But rather, you have gotten to the point where you're pushing the limits of your expansion consciously. Consciously pushing those limits. Consciously pushing your development in a conscious evolution and directing it in the way you wish. That is actually the point of experiential realization. When the therapeutic session has gotten you to the point where you have that power. So we no longer think of it in terms of therapy. We think of it in terms of you have become one of the dynamic forces for evolution in this world. And I think that's just great. I think this way of understanding things and this way of seeing life is a very important experience. It's a very valuable experience. And I think it answers questions about why are we here and what is the purpose of our life and what is really the evolutionary process by which things may occur, by which things may manifest. And it really answers a lot of questions. It really answers a lot of doubts and clarifies things. So I'm thankful for my little kitty cat cutting me this morning. And he's very happy with himself. I'll show you here. He's in a really great condition now. He thinks it's just really cool what he did, and he's very proud of himself, and that's okay. I mean, after all, it's fine. Wherever knowledge may come from, wherever understanding may come from, that's fine. There's no need to judge it. There's no need to condemn it. It is what it is. And ultimately, it has value. I'm not going to say ultimately it's good, because sometimes it really stinks, but it has value. What that value is, we may not always be able to understand immediately, but we can understand it at one point. And I would be surprised if we haven't already understood this at one point or another. I would be surprised if it's not true that we don't understand this at one point. Everybody understands this very point I've talked about at one point or another. It's just that when we understand it, we realize we have such an enormous responsibility in this world that we get afraid and we push it away again. I have three questions. The first question is very difficult to answer. What is first? Is it our wish to be in this therapy environment, or is it the Supreme's? Whoa, what a question. I don't think I can answer that really, but I'm going to try to say something about it. I mean, if I was to try to comprehend why this is, that would be a very difficult thing to do. Of course, comprehending what it is easier. To talk about the purpose of existence, the meaning of life, this is easier because, after all, you can just look around you. You can experience. And from the experience, you can extrapolate what the purpose of it is, because we have rationality, we have capacity to see cause and effect. So considering our experience with cause and effect, when we see an effect, we can understand the cause. But when you ask the question, why, you have to not only see cause and effect, you have to go into motive. You have to go into desires, into motives. And anybody who knows about courts and legal proceedings knows that the most complex of all aspects is to prove motive. Why you did what you did. Why you thought what you thought. Why you wanted what you wanted. Or maybe it wasn't even that you wanted it. Maybe there was no motive. It was an unmotivated action that happened by accident. Maybe it was circumstances which forced you into the situation. And there you were, having to deal with it. All of this is possible. So trying to understand the motive, the reason, the wish, why? Whose wish is it? Not only do we have to understand why in this question, because if we say it's a wish, there has to be why, because you don't just one day wake up and desire to, you know, go to hell. There's a why behind it, and I'm sure this is the why is much more important than the specific wish, because the wish we already know about, we're here. Now, the question is first to understand why are we here? And then the second question is to ask, well, who's causing it to happen? So if we could understand the motivation, then understanding the cause of the manifestation of it is easier. That's why at the scene of a crime, they always try to understand motive. Why could this have possibly happened? Like, for example, in a crime scene, because motive, and this is a very important aspect of crime, why was this person beaten or harmed? Is it because of a marital conflict? Was it something about money? Was it because somebody had a grudge? They had something against you? So what happens is that you have to figure out the why, and then figuring out the how and the who is much easier. So now we have to deal with why. Why are we here? Well, this is a really cosmic kind of question. And the reason it's a cosmic kind of question is because actually nobody really knows. We have no experience why we are here. Not direct. Therefore, there are religions and there are books which say why we are here. And if you like, you can believe that. Now, let's say we do accept this idea of this world as being a therapy session. Why are we in this therapy session? What is the motive for placing us in therapy? Well, therapy can be started either that I want it to take place, so I go to a therapist, or some higher authority has said, I need therapy. Sometimes the court says, you need therapy. You have abused your family. You need therapy. Go. Or sometimes I say, I'm screwed up. I need therapy. So I go. These are the two main reasons why one would be in therapy. It's either you're forced to go or you want to go. And sometimes we see those who are forced to go end up wanting to go. There's a famous TV show in America called The Sopranos. I don't know if you've ever seen that there. Do you have that in Russia, The Sopranos? Sopranos. Do you have that in Russia? It's an HBO show. It's a really super famous show in America. Anyway, so in this show, the guy's a gangster. He's the head of the mafia in New Jersey. It's a state. And he goes to therapy. Unfortunately, most of what I know about the psychotherapy process is what I've seen on that show. But it's cool. It's really realistic. And my wife, who's a therapist, says it's a very realistic thing. So this idea of therapy, this guy, he didn't want to go to therapy. He was forced to go because he was having these attacks and he was collapsing. So his wife forced him to go to the therapy. And when he first went, he said, you know, I don't care about this and you're all bogus and the whole thing is useless and I'm just wasting my time. But, you know, the show went on for 7 years and he was going to therapy all the time because it turned out that he liked it because he realized there was something in it which was good for him. So that is an interesting point because either you want to or you're forced to and then you want to. That's possible because if you think about it, no therapy can be successful unless you cooperate. All right, now we've got all kinds of questions. If I want to do it, that's easy. But why would I want to do it? What state of being am I in which is so screwed up, I think I need to go to therapy? Now, that's a mind-boggling question. If all there is therapy or this beautiful spiritual world, what state of being was I in before I entered into therapy, which was so screwed up that I needed to go to therapy? Therefore, some people say, you were never in the spiritual world because nobody in the spiritual world needs therapy. There's no need for it. There's no therapist's office. You know, you don't have a Dr. Sham in Goloka where you go and sign in at the receptionist, you know, Vrinda Devi receptionist. And then you go into the, you know, doctor's office and pay him in Sandesh. It doesn't happen. It's not there. So what state is it so? So therefore people say, obviously, they conclude like this, obviously, you were never in that place. Well, then it becomes really complicated. So then this creation of categories has taken place. Because these questions have been dealt with by religions. especially in Vaishnavism, which is the most sophisticated discussion about the origins of living beings. And in esoteric Christian traditions, they've also dealt with this very completely. Now, that means there's a category of beings who never were in the perfect condition. But wait a minute. Hang on. Hold on. Hold everything. Now we have another problem. How long were they screwed up before they realized they needed therapy? Okay, let's say you've got this bunch of people who are not in the spiritual realm because they're screwed up. Now, if they are always in therapy, now please understand this point, it's very wild. If they are always in therapy, that means from the beginning of existence, and there's no beginning, that means eternally they're in therapy. So there's no question of who decided. There's no question of wish. There's no question of desire. Because it always was so. Wow. Now, if it always was so, that sounds pretty rotten for us who are here. I mean, we are in this horrible situation where we are always here and not happy about it. Can you imagine that? Does that mean the whole purpose of what we're doing here is to be happy about being here? And therefore smiling detachment is the ultimate? Mind-boggling question. So then the solution is no. You go from here to there, where there's others who have always been there. But amongst those who've always been there, there are some who can come down here. But again, we've got this question. How do you get so screwed up that you need therapy? So there's this like battle going on. It's a battle of thought, a battle of concept, a battle of words. You've either got this situation where there are a group of screwed up souls who are in some screwed up realm. And when they realize they need therapy, they come here in the realm of therapy. Or if you figure that's impossible, you say they've always been in the realm of therapy. Or if you think that's impossible, you say they've always been up there until one point when they're not, and they come down to the realm of therapy. Each idea has more questions than it answers. Therefore, from that point of view, you could do one of two things. You could say, I don't feel like worrying about it. I don't care about it. It's too complicated. Or you could say, I want to talk about it. I want to get into it. I want to figure it out. Either way, it's fine. And whatever you want to believe, it's fine. Now, sometimes people hear me say that and they go, that means everything is fine. All is fine. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is either possibility to not worry about it or to worry about it is equally useless or beneficial to you depending on what you need. And from that point of view, both are fine. That doesn't mean everything everywhere is fine, because some things are not fine. That's why we go to therapy. That's why we ask questions. That's why we struggle with the purpose of life. But the methodology you take to figure it out is okay, as long as it's giving you something, as long as it's assisting you in your movement towards a solution for yourself. And then again, if there's no solution, it's helping you move towards peace. It's helping you move towards acceptance. And it's helping you move towards dynamic expansion of your existence. So when I'm asked this question, what's first, our wish to take therapy or it's the Supreme's forcing us to do it? This is such a cosmic question. This is such a monstrously enormous question that it doesn't have an answer. In other words, it doesn't have this is it. The this is it, at least I cannot give. You can find, again, gurus. You can find popes. You can find imams. You can find personalities who will say this is the answer and who will be very convinced of it. And that's okay, as long as that answer works for you. Frankly speaking, it doesn't work for me. I'm in the category of I don't worry about it until I have to worry about it. When I have to worry about it, I talk about it and come to the conclusion there's no use worrying about it because worrying about it doesn't help. So I stop worrying about it until I have to worry about it. You get the point. Now I know a lot of people are going to say that was one lousy answer. Some people are going to say, and they would be right, that was a really lousy answer. But it's the best one I can give you. And again, it's part of the therapy session. It's part of the therapy session that you've got to look around and you've got to say, now why am I here in this place? And you've got to come up with your answer. As long as you're asking the question. Okay, here's an example which I think is really going to capture your imagination. Let's say you're eating ice cream. Or let's say you're eating a pizza. And you're eating that and you go, this is good. You're just tasting it. And then in the middle of eating the pizza or the ice cream, you say, you think, why am I eating this pizza? What is the point of this pizza? What is the purpose of this pizza? Where did this pizza come from anyway? Why do I have to eat anyway? What is the meaning of this experience of cheese and tomato and wheat on my tongue? What is this taste anyway? What is it all about? Now you can just imagine what that experience of eating pizza is going to become. Some people have sex just like that. And they have to go to therapy for years to deal with that. Because the idea is to have the experience, not to analyze it while it's going on. You can analyze it afterwards, or maybe before. Let's say if you're too fat. So you can analyze before you eat the ice cream. Eating this ice cream is not good for me. It's bad for my cholesterol. And then because you've analyzed eating it before you ate it, you don't eat it. Same thing with sex. Having sex with that person is not good. It's going to screw up this and that and the other thing. So you avoid it. Analysis is good before. It's also good after if you've screwed things up. But while you're doing something, analysis is the wrong thing. Not always, but I mean, if you're eating ice cream or pizza or doing other things, yes, it's the wrong thing. Just get into the experience. Enjoy your pizza. Feel guilty later. If when the pizza came in front of you, you don't feel guilty, well, don't feel guilty while you're eating it. It's going to make you really neurotic. Feel guilty after you eat it. Now, I'm sorry, Jasmuheen was just there, and probably nobody's eating. Everybody's living on light, and I'm talking about pizza. And I'm really sorry. My God, I just realized it. I'm probably screwing up everybody royally. And you're going to need to go into therapy. And I'm really sorry about that. And I won't talk about pizza again. And I'm not going to mention ice cream either. Okay. I see. Food is there in the flat. Good. So now, just consider these points. I think that dealing with this situation of life is extremely complex. But you can make it less complex if you live in the moment, if you live in the now, if you live in the present. Because when you live in the past and the future, then all of these questions of why am I in the therapy office? Who put me here? What is the point? All this past stuff, way back. You know, you think about it in another way. When you're in the present, you don't worry about it. Okay, you're aware of it. It's in your data bank. You reach into memory. And you can do things now. But you don't use this as a way to try to justify the present. Or justify your future, or rationalize your course of action. It's just a means to deal with the experience of the now. Because it's only in the now that you can come to some terms, some peace, some acceptance of what's right in front of you. Did I lose you? It's only in the now that you can come to terms. You can deal with. You can accept. Now, okay. Therefore, I think I have this question answered. But then the second question is also cool from same party. Is it possible in this process of therapy we become more sick than we were before we started the process? Okay, this is a big problem with healing therapies. Because just like people who go to therapy and then come home are usually impossible at home, at least for a while. Because they're all filled with all these like ideas of what the therapist and all these things, and they're blaming everybody and they're trying to deal with it and understand everything, and they're filled with emotions and they're filled with trauma from the past, and they take it out on the people at home. And everybody goes, oh God, she just came back from therapy. Oh God, he just went through therapy. Oh God, oh man, when is it over? This is a natural phenomena that takes place in every therapeutic psychotherapeutic kind of a session. But not only in psychotherapy, it also goes on when you're doing physical healing. For example, in homeopathy. In homeopathy, it's a very interesting experience that you go through a healing crisis. If the medicine is perfect, you can first get a little worse or a lot worse before you get a lot better. This is also there in herbal medicine sometimes. Reactions as the body has to adjust. So this is called a healing crisis. So in some cases, it's so that you can get worse before you get better. Just like if you've had a cathartic experience. You know what that is? Cathartic experience. It means catharsis. It means that you're blowing up, you're exploding, you're running around screaming, bouncing off the walls and back. But when it's all over, you lay there and go, and you feel much better. That's called a cathartic experience, where you're going through this complete chaos inside, and then you just feel better when you get it all out. But for those around you, it's like, oh man. So, yes, it's so. And if you look at life as a big healing session, then you can understand that sometimes lifetimes are worse than other lifetimes because we're feeling worse than we were feeling before. Now I've got another question, which is related to what I spoke about in the lecture, actually. So this person is saying that she agrees very much with the statement of the Urantia book that the purpose of life is to become as much like God as possible already on this level of existence on this planet. And that this is not a painful therapeutic process of finding defects in oneself, but rather a continuous creative process. Now, I think, of course, already what I spoke about in this lecture and in others agrees totally with the first sentence of this. That when I spoke about we become the therapists, that means we take on roles as the role of God in this therapeutic environment. So we develop that divine quality of being of service, of understanding, of being there for others, of facilitating, of arranging, of assisting. So that is definitely true. Now, but the second part, that this is not a painful therapeutic process of finding defects in oneself, but rather a continuous creative process. Well, let's talk about creative processes. Let's talk about those who are engaged in creative processes. Now, I'll talk as a musician. And I know historically there are others who, like Mozart, like Beethoven, I mentioned the most famous, whose creative process was filled with pain. Why? In Mozart's case, because of his abusive father, who was also a famous composer. I don't know if you know that, Leopold Mozart. His father was a very great composer too. He wrote nice symphonies. Beethoven's father was so insane that he beat him so severely that he developed this problem with his ears, which ultimately made him deaf. And the pain of his creativity, his creative process, was so handicapped when he became deaf. Process of creativity was so painful for him. Let's talk just about me, because I can talk about me. I know me. So let's say I'm going to write some musical piece. And I can, of course, do it fast. I can just let it rip off spontaneously. But it'll only be up to a certain level of quality. If I'm going to make it really good, I mean really good, that you're going to listen to it and say, woo, this is going to take days and days, perhaps weeks. This process of creative experience, this process of creativity, can be incredibly painful. You could, in fact, record a track over 20 times I don't know if you know it, but one of the most significant, the most revolutionary, and most defining music in the whole pop music, rock music scene was the product of one of the most incredible, painful experiences anyone could ever have. Now, I don't know how up you are on music history, but I'll tell you anyway. The Beach Boys is a very famous group, but some people may know them and not know them so much. Beach Boys, yeah. Beach Boys. Help me, Rhonda. Help me, Rhonda. Help me, Rhonda. But then you might know it more by good. Good vibrations. Okay, if you haven't heard it, go listen to it. But anyway, for those who know, they know that this one song, Good Vibrations, was the culmination of the redefinition of music at that time. That the Beatles were completely influenced by this and moved into another direction. Everything in music changed after that song. That song was considered to be the defining pivotal moment in music history amongst those who know, amongst those who are composers, amongst those who are writers, amongst those who are producers, amongst musicians. Today, even you listen to this song and you see elements in it which are still attractive, which are classic, which are defining. And they make documentaries which are explaining to the newer generation the actual guy who did all that, Brian Wilson. Yet, Brian Wilson disappeared sometime around 1967 when trying to make an album and did not reappear until about 2 years ago because he was in such a bad psychic condition, practically in a state of insanity, heavily drugged, heavily institutionalized at one point, having to be completely secluded because his father was the most abusive kind of person you can imagine, because he was so crushed by his father, because it was the time where the whole world was transforming from the insanely conservative 50s. Now, I grew up in the 1950s, and very few of you people have a clue what that means. It was so conservative, you cannot imagine. And even the 60s, when things were supposedly getting less conservative, if you see videos of music shows in the 60s, or, you know, up to 65, 66, 67, it's like amusing. You know, the girls are going like this. This is like really hot dancing amongst the girls, right? Can you imagine this? I'm serious. That was at the time considering really hot stuff, you know? And then they would look at you like this, and that was really hot stuff. And today, if a kid were to look at those videos from then, they would say, Mommy, what's wrong with these people? And that was already completely transformed from the 50s. And then we got this whole transformation of music, and then we got Brian Wilson, who comes up out of this, and him and Lennon McCartney are influencing each other. But Brian Wilson was this genius who put together layers of music. But the pain, it took him hundreds of tracks. That song was recorded in maybe 5 different studios at maybe, you know, so many different times, hundreds of times. The studio musicians are talking about it. They were playing the same track. This song is only 2.5 minutes long or something like that. 2.5 minutes. And they had to play these tracks over and over and over. they would play it perfectly. And he would say, no, it's not perfect. And you can imagine, they're just playing. Can you imagine doing that 100 times? You lose your mind. They wanted to strangle him. Brian Wilson. The musicians. The recording engineer wanted to strangle him. The pain that went into that creative process cannot be understood by us. And yet, it was one of the greatest creations that was so powerful, it transformed generations. So, even though, I don't think this developing qualities like God should be a painful process, yet, if we say it's a continuous creative process, creative processes almost always go along with pain. Let's take writing. Now, I get information from my university, and my old university, and in my old university, it's probably one of the most powerful places for authors to congregate and for writing to be taught. But these writers, they had a conference, and they were talking about the pain they have to go through to put these words on paper. So there are so many aspects of creative processes which are so painful, yet so important, so significant, and which in fact can propel an ordinary growth into a jet-propelled growth. So to simply say that expansion and evolution is a painless process, I would disagree with entirely. In my opinion, and it's only my opinion, this process of creativity where we have to deal with ourselves and deal with our limitations is something which propels it to heights we could have never attained. And don't forget, therapy is not just about finding defects in yourself. It's also about understanding other people. It's about understanding your relationship with the world. It's about understanding how you can adjust to make other people more comfortable. And also, in many cases, it's a question of fixing something you did in your creativity which you don't like. You want to make it better. Okay, maybe it's not a defect. You wouldn't say, if I were to make a line that went da 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 ba ba do 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 boop beep and I didn't like it, that it's because it was defective. Maybe, considering the context of the song, it might have been much better to go ba 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 da ba 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 ba. Sometimes something is not in the right context. We have to fix it. Sometimes something is not, even just you make a slip of the finger, we have to fix it. Sometimes I misunderstand the mood of the song. I've got to fix it. I may have thought I was playing fine, but everybody else thought, huh? What's this guy playing? So I've got to fix it. The only way to fix it is to understand how it's wrong. So as you evolve to making it better, you've got to modify that which is not any longer relevant, not any longer useful. That which later on you look back and you say, that was really primitive. So that's my answer to that particular statement. Now I got another question. I said that we are expanding all the time. But if there is only ever existent present, then in which dimension do we expand? Because here in our three-dimensional space, every movement is happening in time. Yes. But let's now go and examine what we mean when we say expand. Now, we have to use words in a context. So now, let's just take a simple example. We're skinny today. We eat 15 pizzas tomorrow. We expand. That has to do with time. So today in the present, we're skinny. In the future, in the present, we're fatter. Now, if you were a perfect existentialist following the existential philosophy, if you were like Camus or Sartre, somebody like that, you wouldn't even consider being fat or skinny, because you just were wherever you were. You could have a yogi thinking the same way. All that counts is right now. So whether or not I'm expanding or not physically, or it doesn't matter. So from that point of view, you wouldn't use the word expand, because expand means to go from a smaller to a bigger. And the only reason it has meaning is because at this point in time you are smaller, and at this point in time you are bigger. Because in the same point of time you can't be smaller and bigger at the same time. But here we are going to check ourselves into insane asylums. Because then we would have to negate the fact that things do happen over time. Let me define this insanity again. If you say everything exists now and nothing else exists, then what about your memory? Where's your memory? Then again, why would you wash your clothes? Can you answer why you would wash your clothes? Well, I'll answer it for you. Because they stink. Right now, you go like this and go, and you go, ah, what a stink. So you put your shirt in the laundry and you wash it. Why do you wash it? Because you know when the machine stops spinning and you take it out and it dries, it won't stink. So you can wear it. All of a sudden, the now ended up into a plan for the future. Why did you have such a plan? Because in the past, you took stinky shirts, put them in the laundry, dried them, and they got clean. Now, that's the way it works. The present is all that exists. But you make plans so that these next moments of present are more bearable. You can live with them. You can have clean shirts. So we live in this context of time. Now let's say all we did was live in the present, and we didn't worry about anything. We had no experience that if you wash your shirt, it gets clean, because we don't remember it. And we have no idea of the future, so we would never put the shirt in a laundry, because we would never know that it would end up being clean. You understand why I say you would have to be insane? Because you would simply just wander around or sit somewhere. You wouldn't even eat, because you wouldn't have any money to buy any food, because you wouldn't work to get money. I guess we were so much into this like insanity of the situation that the computer said, why should I even continue processing? Why should I work to make money? Why should I go shopping? What is the reason to do anything? So you can understand the insanity of the whole situation. So therefore, when you say, where do we expand? Well, we expand our consciousness. And that expands over time, from smaller to bigger. That means we become more aware. We become clearer. We become less covered. We become able to contact and connect. So because your question was specifically related to the happening in time, I had to challenge that. Now, if you say that such kinds of consciousness and awareness do not happen in time, that they are related to the etheric, and there is no time, well, then there's no question either. Did I answer that?
Not exactly. For example, in spiritual world, there is no time, but something happening still there. Some expansion is going on there. So how it happens there?
Is the question really about...
If there is no time, then how, what does it mean expansion there in spiritual world? If there is no time there.
So the question really is how is time related to expansion? Now, I understand the question is, if there's no time, how does anything expand? I understand that. But let's talk about, you're using the spiritual world term. Let's talk about, why would the gopis prepare Sandesh for Krishna if there was no time? Just think about that. To prepare Sandesh, you have to do the exact same things you do anywhere. You have to get milk, turn it to cheese, you know, knead the cheese with the bar, and or your fingers, your palm, I mean, put in the sugar, right? Dry it out first, of course, and then you have to press it into the right form and cut it, maybe put the silver or gold on top. This is a process. So if you're trying to define the spiritual world as a place where there's no time, and there's no ever-present, and there's only ever-present existence, you are making the same mistake as I analyzed in the material so-called world. Because it's the exact same thing, because that's all there is. If you were to say there's only the ever-present, you would have the exact same situation. Why would somebody make Sandesh? You understand? It's the exact same situation. And up there, it would be just as insane as it would be here to speak in such terms. The problem is when you make a statement like, there is no time in the spiritual world. That's the mistake. Now, how would we deal with it? We would therefore say, the deteriorating effects of time are not in the spiritual world. If you wanted to say something, that would be the best thing to say. Time is not a force that you have to deal with. Time becomes a servant by which things may happen. So did I answer the question?
So I understood that in spiritual world and here, the time present in both, but the quality is different of time.
I would not say that. I would not say the quality of time is different in the spiritual world and quote-unquote material world. Because all there is this existence. I would say that we are affected by it differently than in the so-called spiritual world, people would be affected by it. Just like a diamond is affected by time differently than a peach. A peach will rot very fast. A diamond will rot very slowly. So all you can really say is, time is the same because it just means existence, but that we or things here, so-called, are affected by it differently there. And that's why when we speak about the etheric realm, time doesn't have that effect. But you are very aware, you start a meditation, you may end up in that realm, and you go through time in the meditation, and then end it. But you're not limited by time in that way. You could, for example, bring yourself back in time. Bring yourself to other locations on this physical timeline. Or rather, how this physical realm relates to the timeline. It doesn't mean that it does not exist in the etheric realm. But it means that when we are there, we are not affected by it in the same way as when we are here. Etheric bodies do not rot. This one does. So now did we answer the question? Okay.